Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Last week, Pennsylvania's 25 state correctional institutions were locked down as the nation's drug crisis was being felt even behind prison walls. Exposure to synthetic drugs like K2 were sickening prison personnel. Prisons in two other states, Ohio and Arkansas, also went on lockdown for the same reason. How are the drugs getting into the prisons? What can be done about it? And are workers and inmates at risk? Joining us this morning is Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections, John Wetzel. Secretary Wetzel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And I should add to that introduction that the Allegheny County Prison also on lockdown this morning because several prison workers were sickened over the weekend. Secretary Wetzel, so are state prisons locked down as we speak?
Yes. It's a little less of a lockdown than it was when we initially started it, in that we started to slowly open back up and have some controlled exercise on housing units. And we'll continue to slowly ramp back up, but its visits and mail are still not happening right now, although phone calls are.
So when you say that you slowly are ramping back up and you mention exercise, originally a lot of the prison the entire prison population was kept in their cells. No yard, no access to the yard. They were being fed their meals inside cells. So has that changed at all?
Yeah, we're starting to do more out-of-cell activity, but it's slow. It's not nowhere close to normal operation. And understand, we had six staff members exposed at Albion to what we believe to be this synthetic cannabinoids. And then shortly thereafter, Ohio sent 20 people out. And this has really been a phenomenon in primarily our western facilities. The furthest east facilities that had staff exposures were SCI Benner and State College and Camp Hill, both of which are transportation hubs. So this certainly was a western facility, but given the unknown nature of this, it seemed like the prudent thing to do. So since then, we've just over the weekend went our first 24-hour period without having a staff member exposed. So that really gave us the confidence to start slowly opening back up. The posture was really to make sure we were protecting staff and inmates. I mean, I think some of the things that get lost in this dialogue is that the majority of inmates aren't using drugs, and they want a drug-free environment also. And the effects of K2 are increasing violence, not just with the drug trade, but people under the influence of K2 act very erratically. I mean, you can just go to YouTube and Google K2 effects, and it's pretty scary stuff to have to manage in a prison environment.
And I'm going to be jumping around with a lot of questions, some basic questions, Secretary. What about danger to the public? Is there any danger to the public?
I don't think so. I mean, there's K2 in the public, and I believe that Dr. Levine and Jen Smith, our Secretary of Drug and Alcohol and Department of Health, had a press conference last week about the effects of these synthetics out in the community. But as it relates to, from a prison standpoint, one of the reasons we stopped the mail was because we didn't want anything sent out or coming in. And mail is one of the kind of six highways that that drugs are coming in. And you may recall several months ago, some K2 or synthetic cannabinoid was sent to the police barracks, the state police barracks in Carlisle, and it required the barracks to be evacuated, and some staff members over there were affected by it. So just to that extent, that was the sole instance I can give you where the public was at risk.
From what I understand, though, this is not new, that this has happened in the past. What's different about this time?
So specifically the mechanism that this brand of K2 is coming in, keep in mind it's an odorless, pretty much undetectable liquid, right? So as it relates to mail, people soaking paper in it. But even beyond that, we recently got some intelligence about people putting this in ink and then printing it onto a paper. So because it's with the mail in particular, because it's difficult to detect, I think the volume coming in was significant. And at the same time, staff has not been impacted, getting what's called a particulate exposure. They're not breathing it in. It's contact. But like you're walking through a room and there's a piece of paper laying on the floor, a natural instinct is to pick up the paper. And in some of these exposure cases, it was just like that. Pick up the paper, touch your face, and then you start feeling the effects. And for what the exposure specifically is, it's the effect of K2. So people say, well, why are just staff feeling the exposure and inmates aren't? Because the inmates who are getting exposed are choosing to get high, right? So the what our staff is feeling is the effects of K2.
Those effects, they've been described as the staff becoming ill, but you just said that they're getting high as well. I mean, if you would, describe some of the illnesses or some of the effects that the staff has suffered from this.
Yeah, we've seen difficulty breathing, dizziness, kind of flush face, sweatiness, sometimes breaking out in a rash, heart rate increased, blood pressure increased. On the verge of passing out, kind of thing. And part of the nature is when there's so many unknowns, it creates anxiety, right? And so imagine you're walking into work and you don't know what's making people sick, but something's making people sick. It just created a really poor environment inside our facilities. Which is why we had to take these serious steps.
K2 has been described as synthetic cannabis, but I saw an email from the governor's office last week, a tweet actually, that said it shouldn't be referred to as synthetic marijuana because it is not marijuana, although it does. That's the official name, cannabis.
Yeah, it's. I think. And I'm certainly not speaking for the I think that was J.J. Abbott.
Yes.
Certainly not speaking for J.J., but this is more serious than marijuana. It's more, I think it would be more closely aligned to a methamphetamine or something along those lines. It's certainly synthetic, and the formula changes, which opens up the potential to have things like fentanyl or something as part of the compound. Which obviously has been, killing people all over the place. And I think the other thing that's a real challenge is some of these compounds, an overdose is not reversible by Narcan. So again, it's certainly more serious. I think what you don't want is the perception that it's just like smoking pot, because it's not. It's very different and a lot more serious and potentially a lot more detrimental to somebody's health.
You mentioned mail, but what are some of the other ways that the drugs are making their way into the prisons?
Yeah, so basically there's six highways, right, that drugs are coming in. You got regular mail, legal mail, coming in through visits, coming in through books and publications that get sent in, something we don't like to talk about but is important to give the whole picture is sometimes staff are compromised and staff bring it in. And then the sixth highway is by drones, actually dropping them into inside the secure perimeter. Some states have had significant challenges with drones. We've had a couple instances of drones, but certainly not to the extent other states are. But with that being said, understand that one of the reasons we've done this lockdown is because we're going to announce tomorrow. The governor and I are going to announce a comprehensive response that takes steps to eliminate all six of these pathways that drugs come in. And that's critical. I mean, just think about you're driving somewhere, and with the weekend flooding, this is a very relevant example. A road gets closed down. The traffic on the other roads then ramps up, right? So if you close down, let's say we close down the path where drugs are coming in through the mail, certainly the other five paths are going to get more attention. So it's really critical that we have a comprehensive approach. I mean, everybody's heard of the butterfly effect, right, where, a butterfly flying on the other side of the, the world has an impact here. This is a much smaller system, so any change we make anywhere will have an immediate impact in other ways. So the response has to be comprehensive, it has to be immediate, and it has to be effective. And we intend to take significant steps to reel this in. But I also want to say that we want to strike a balance, because things like visits and mail are important. We know that inmates who get visits from their families, especially in the last year, have less likelihood of committing a crime. And that connection to families, having pro-social supports, that's critical. So, you know, part of the challenge here is that we're having a negative impact on that. And so we want to come up with this way to stop drugs in and then ramp that stuff back up so we can get back to a normal operation where we're really trying to create opportunities for quality interactions between inmates and their loved ones.
It is amazing how creative people can get to do things like this. But I know that from our previous conversations that it is very important to you. You see this as one of the key ingredients in keeping former inmates out of jail from recommitting crimes and going back to jail, is that they are located closer to their homes so that they do get visits from their family. I mean, how do you strike that balance you just were describing?
Yeah, I mean, you just try to make the next right. You just try to do the next right thing. I mean, it is a challenge, and in this environment, and because of what's at stake, because we've had staff exposed, we've had inmates have detrimental things happen to them, we've had overdoses in a system that traditionally doesn't have this, we have to take serious steps. But we always have to keep focus on what our job is. And our job is to have people leave our system better than they came in. And so while this is a short-term impediment to some of the things we like to do, we have to shore this up. I really felt like we really needed to stabilize the system, create that safe environment, and then we can go back to business as usual. And again, I just got to stress that the majority of inmates are not using drugs. We random drug test hundreds of inmates a month, and it's less than 1% that test positive, right? But the implications are serious, and that's why we have to take these serious steps.
Have you had inmates that have overdosed?
Yes, we have.
How do you, obviously they are treated medically, but what about the investigations? Have you investigated and people are arrested for supplying those drugs?
Yeah, when you can hunt it down. It's not just like all drug investigations and overdose investigations. It's rarely a straight line and it's rarely simple to do that. We pursue charges whenever possible. On individuals bringing drugs in, individuals in possession of drugs, and we anticipate really ramping that up. We anticipate doing some things as far as maybe a drug hotline, that kind of approach, maybe working with Crime Stoppers. We work well with our law enforcement partners, and sharing information and collecting intel, especially around drugs and gangs and those kinds of things. We're going to maximize our use of those resources and those partnerships, and really double down on focusing on stopping drugs from coming in. At the same time, we have to address addiction, right? I think you've heard me talk before about the war on drugs not being a bad concept. We just fought it on one front, which is trying to take the supply out with ignoring the demand. We're not going to replicate that mistake. We need to still be providing programming that gets to the root cause, and you know, part of this issue is that people desire to use drugs. So you have to address the addiction, and that's been a, you know, kind of important point of the governor's attack on the opioid epidemic is balancing that, focusing on treatment and on enforcement in a balanced way. And that's really what we're trying to replicate here.
We're going to take some phone calls and emails in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. By the way, there is a Smart Talk road trip this week, York City Development and Revitalization. It's the topic for the next Smart Talk road trip on September 6th, this Thursday, at Martin Library in York. Join us from 9 to 10 a.m. for the live broadcast. RSVP at WITF.org/events. Our guest during this portion of the program is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Corrections, John Wetzel. We're talking about the state corrections institutions being locked down since last week with exposure to drugs to much of the prison staff. I shouldn't say much, many of the prison staff, people getting sick and ill and trying to stop it, where it's coming from, all those topics. If you have a question for Secretary Wetzel, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a few phone calls here. Secretary, Tristina is in Easton. Tristina, you're on the air.
Hi. My first question was about visitation. I heard rumor that basically they would be cutting off our visitations for contact.
Yeah, that's not accurate. We intend to restore visits once we announce the plan and start ramping up back to normal operation.
Okay. And then I had a second question about the scanners that you guys just introduced up at Cole. There's the one body scanner. What is, like, the longevity of that, and how is that going to affect inmates? And is this, I feel like this is a way to just make it more needed, you know, this whole lockdown.
All right. Thank you very much. What about the body scanners? We've heard that that is one of the, I don't know if I want to say solutions, but one of the ways that you're fighting this.
So there's a new technology with body scanners. I would say, just to give your listeners some point of reference, similar to what you go through at the airport. That's certainly next generation technology. It's not just a metal detector. We initiated at SCI Cole. And drugs, the price of drugs went up, the supply of drugs went down significantly. So it is effective. It's just like at the airport, radiation is a piece of it. So there's guidelines. An individual can't be scanned more than 167, I believe, times a year, which is basically every other day. How we're using it at Cole right now is people coming out of the visit rooms, which obviously is one of the primary paths for drugs to come in, and also individuals coming back from court and those kinds of things, which is another one of those paths. So we're in the process right now of purchasing those for each prison in the state. So that is absolutely going to be part of our response. It's an effective solution to continue to improve and make a safer environment inside the prisons.
Is that permanent?
Yes.
You know, this, I think about this, and most often when we think about contraband coming into to prison, you know, we've gotten ideas from television, movies, things like that. But is there other contraband coming in that, you know, these body scanners, for example, can detect?
Certainly. Weapons, for instance, certainly does a great job of detecting weapons. And really, anything that you have on your body or in your body, which is, you know, that's kind of one of the mechanisms that things get smuggled into prisons and out of visit rooms and into general population is through individuals ingesting things. And this gives us the ability to see inside somebody and if they've even swallowed a balloon which is a kind of common mechanism that things like Suboxone, which is another thing that's often smuggled inside prisons, it's very common for that to come in. And this machine detects that.
At airports, the body scanners, privacy was an issue. Obviously, a prison is a much different situation. I mean, rules for visitors, do they give up their privacy rights if they are going to visit an inmate?
Now, we are not using the body scanners on visitors currently. They're being used on inmates coming out of the visit room. And we have not made that decision, or we're actually not contemplating right now using that on visitors. But with that being said, there's absolutely visitors will be searched coming into prison, and that's part of what you agree to when you come in to visit somebody.
Let's go to Chris in Philadelphia. Chris, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's actually Crystal, and I am a transportation provider out of Philadelphia, DOT approved. And so my question is, the inmates, we are getting calls. So the calls have been opening up, emails have been opening up, and some of the institutions aren't following the protocol for allowing the inmates to come out. So family members are concerned. They want to know what's going on with their loved ones. They want to know how they're doing, if they're well, and we haven't heard anything.
Yep, I would encourage them to, they can either send an email or go to the website. They can contact our central office or they can contact the facilities directly. As I said, basically, we began phone calls on Saturday, and out-of-cell time began at a couple facilities over the weekend, and the rest are going to be starting to ramp up today. So that's where everybody's at. But if you're concerned about a loved one, please reach out, and we will have somebody contact you.
The other question I have is, so you are reporting out on staff that have been affected by this K2 epidemic. We aren't getting reports about inmates and how many inmate deaths and how many inmate incidents are occurring. Where do we find that information?
Yeah, I think, well, we report on that yearly, but in we can certainly add that to our, we have a website page dedicated to this issue, and we're in the process of populating that page with a bunch of information surrounding the press conference tomorrow and the announcement. So I would encourage you to look at that that page on our public website probably tomorrow afternoon, evening, or no later than the day after that.
Crystal, thank you very much for your call. Let's take a call from Jane in Harrisburg. Jane, you're on the air.
Good morning. First, let me say to Mr. Wetzel, I was very impressed by the portrayal of you on 60 Minutes, and I certainly do hope that you will continue that progression in a positive, not negative manner. Let me also say that I'm very concerned about the health and well-being of the staff. However, I find it offensive that the staff is not subjected to drug testing. And I understand that this is a possibility because then the state would have to pay for their rehabilitation. I'm also wanting to mention that visitors are drug screened. There are times when we are also sniffed by the dogs. And if we can be sniffed by the dogs, I'm not sure I don't understand why the male cannot be sniffed by the dogs, and those who are offending are punished. There's no reason for the male to not be, screened. And if someone's sending in drugs, they should be punished. The visitors are also, and loved ones are not, this was a misstep. We are not sending in things via books and magazines because books and magazines come directly from Barnes & Noble and Amazon. They do not come from the loved ones themselves. I think that this entire situation is painting a very dreadful picture of our inmates, our loved ones, some of which who do not deserve this kind of a negative portrayal. It's having a dreadful effect, not just on the inmates, on the families as well, who are being punished by no visitation. And I can tell you from the perspective of a loved one of mine who gets a lot of support that he's seeing very detrimental effects to the inmates. Men who and women who had no, were not calling out, were not screaming, were not crying, were not having nightmares. It's beginning because you can only lock someone down for so long and have it have such a horrible detrimental effect.
Jane,
on them.
Thank you.
I just think that this situation is causing a very negative picture.
Thank you very much for your Jane. Thank you very much for your call, Secretary Wetzel.
Yeah, and perhaps Jane didn't hear me stress this several times. The vast majority of inmates aren't using drugs, and I think I've said that many times. And I agree. It's certainly a lockdown is not an ideal situation. By the same token, when you have a crisis, when you have an emergency, when people's lives and health are at stake, you have to take appropriate measures, and I believe we did. And let me just hit on a couple of the assertions that are just inaccurate. First of all, staff is drug tested, so I don't know where the notion that staff can't be drug tested. What she referred to is trace drug detection that visitors are used. It's also used on staff, and as are the canines. Canines also hit staff vehicles as well as visitor vehicles. So, I refuse to get in to this us versus them situation that's pretty popular right now in America, I guess. We have an issue. And the issue is not a simple, this is not a black and white issue. It's a multi-pronged issue that requires a multi-pronged response. And that's what we're putting together. And to do it safely, staff training is a key piece of it. I mean, right now, as we speak, we're putting together hazmat teams for every prison. So when we do identify a cell that's contaminated, we can do that safely and not have to bring outside folks in to do it, and we can really limit the area and really make it a safer environment for staff and inmates. So I think while this is difficult, and I certainly have empathy towards that, this is a prudent thing to do given the circumstances, given the fact that 29 staff members over, I believe, a three-week period were sent out, 11 just the other night in Allegheny County. I mean, this is serious, folks. And so when the circumstance warrants it, you have to take these steps.
A listener asked a question along those lines, says, I'd like to say my heart goes out to the staff across the state, hope and pray for a safe and speedy recovery for all. I have two questions. I noticed via Twitter newsletter that staff has been ordered to wear gloves. Will they get masks as well? Regular doctor mask, and there are also N44 mask, I believe, that looks like a duck bill that covers the mouth, nose, and eyes. What about that?
Yeah, to this point, we don't believe there's been any particulate exposures. However, we are exploring making that stuff present for staff. We do have some masks. There's some requirement for fit testing around the masks, and also there's some requirement to not have beards and those kinds of things. So to scale that is not as quick. And not that we want to be reactive. Certainly, we try to be proactive whenever possible. So we were exploring that. If that becomes a need, we'll certainly go in that direction. To this point, having a mask would not have eliminated any of the exposures that I'm aware of because it wasn't that particulate type exposure, breathing it in.
Another listener question, what about liquid PCP? Rumors are that this is also getting into the facilities.
There would be a potential for that to happen. I don't know that I can recall a time where we've identified something as liquid PCP, but I'm also not a chemist, and so I'm not sure exactly what is comprised in all the substances that have come in or are coming in.
We've got a lot of questions here, Secretary, about the timeline for when this will be removed. And I know you've mentioned several times that you will talk about this with Governor Wolf tomorrow. But do you have any kind of deadline or any kind of timeline in mind?
In general, again, I told you we've now gone about a day and a half without an exposure, which led to us really starting to increase out of cell time, assuming we'll continue to increase out of cell time certainly through this week, and assuming we don't have any issues, then we'll look to get back to normal hopefully next week. Now, so that's the plan written in pencil. It's written in pencil because if we start having issues as we start opening back up, if we have if exposures kick back up, if we would have anything along the lines of disturbances or anything along those lines, then we'd revisit. But in general, we're going to slowly ramp back up, get services back up, and then hopefully resume normal operation next week, assuming things continue to progress in a positive way.
Let's go to Debbie in Ephrata. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hello, Secretary Westphal. This is a little tiny bit off subject. However, several years ago, there was a 60-minute episode in which you were interviewed, and it was about Germany's prisons and the rehabilitative services that they have there, and also the whole general atmosphere and environment of their prisons. And I would really love to see that emulated in our Pennsylvania prisons, the system that they have in Germany. Is there any way, or are you trying to implement and emulate the system that they have in Germany?
Thank you very much for your call. Secretary, what are they doing in Germany that's different? And, I mean, you obviously, you have been, someone's been lauded nationally for how progressive Pennsylvania prisons have been in trying to change the traditional way of punishment and rehabilitation. But what about Germany?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the German approach and the approach in Europe and America is night and day. I think on the 60 Minutes, I described it as like the difference between the Grand Canyon, where we're at today, and where Europe is. But really, it really focuses around creating an environment that's conducive to people getting well in prison, right? And so we pursue that all the time, and we're working towards that, right? And so how it's, you know, tangentially related to what we're talking about is that the number one thing, if you look at like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, safety and security is number one, right? So you can't rehabilitate people or have people focus on rehabilitation or becoming self-actualized if it's not a safe environment. And that's really what this is about. But yeah, we are working towards that. It's a real keystone to Governor Wolf's approach to criminal justice reform in Pennsylvania. It's really right-sizing our system, putting the right people in for the right amount of time, and then create an environment inside where we can address the needs that drove people to come to prison in the first place and hopefully have them leave the back end of our system less likely to commit a crime than the front end of the system. And we work towards that every day. And certainly the Department of Corrections has gotten a lot of positive press, and that's really a testament to, I think, our staff. I mean, we have just tremendous staff who do great work, and I think our responsibility to them is to make sure they have a safe environment to work in, to do the good work and the important work that the citizens of Pennsylvania rely on them to do.
Secretary Wetzel, I know we were only scheduled to go to about 9:40, but we're getting a lot of people asking questions. Are you able to stay with us till 10?
I actually am not.
Okay.
I actually have to be on another call here in about 5 minutes.
Okay. So, again, the big question that you've answered is, I'm getting a lot of questions here about whether, you know, when this is going to, the lockdown is going to end. Someone also brought up a point here about whether just certain inmates are in lockdown, restricted to cells, or is it everyone?
Well, we did a total lockdown. Now general population inmates are going to start coming out, again, progressively more and more over the next several days, but that'll start today. But yeah, it was a total system lockdown when we announced it on Wednesday. I believe it was Wednesday when we announced it.
You know, one thing I have to bring up is that we're talking about K2. We're talking about synthetic drugs being brought into the prison. In many ways, that may be because of the crackdown on opioids and other nationally produced drugs, illegal drugs outside the prison, is it?
It could be, but again, I think the fact that it's so difficult to detect would make it popular for a place you have to smuggle drugs into.
Mm.
A place that is designed to search and you know, really frustrate those efforts.
Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel. Secretary Wetzel, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And check our website, check our social media pages. We'll continue to put information out, and we're trying to do the right thing here. So just be patient, and we'll get back to normal.
What is the website, by the way?
It's we'll
have a link on our website, WYTF.org.
www.core.pa.gov.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Secretary Wetzel.
All right. Take care.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Chef Donna Desfour will be here, and we will also talk some history about retail stores in downtown Harrisburg. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. September is Hunger Action Month. The national nonprofit organization started Hunger Action Month more than 10 years ago to encourage community involvement in the fight against hunger. Now every September, food banks across the nation join the effort to raise awareness for the problem and encourage volunteers to get involved. The Central Pennsylvania Pennsylvania Food Bank is leading the effort here in our region. Joining us today is Joe Arthur, Executive Director of the Central PA Food Bank, and volunteer Paul Smith. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, the objective of Hunger Action Month, what is it?
It's really about raising awareness and getting a lot of energy for our mission as we go into the heavy holiday season. So September is a great time. And it's also harvest season. So folks are thinking about food. And here in Pennsylvania, we're an agriculture state. It's just a great time to raise awareness for folks that are struggling.
Mm-hmm. Volunteering. Paul, you're a volunteer with the food bank, but it also is a time when not only to bring hunger awareness, but to get other people involved too.
That's exactly right. Because I've learned in the 5 years that I've been volunteering with the food bank that it's the volunteers really that make it work, because there are many, many volunteers and tons of food come in every day. We're there to help unpack it, sort it, and then repack it either into small boxes for individual donation or larger quantities for partner organizations to donate. And when you walk out of the door, you realize that without the volunteer, the food bank would then have to spend money that would normally go to the needy, that normally goes to the needy. They'd have to take some of that money to hire people to do what the volunteers are doing. So it's key, and it really is fulfilling and makes you want to come back the next time.
Joe, I know I've asked you this question as the economy has progressed, but Paul just said tons and tons of food coming in. All the economic news we have heard in recent years has been good. That unemployment, lowest it's been in years. There are a lot of people, a lot of employers out there looking for workers. Wages a little bit stagnant, but I'm not going to go into all the economic indicators. But that would seem to say that there is not as many people who are hungry. Is that the case?
You know, you would think that, right? But it's really a paradox. Underneath the top-level economic numbers, depending on where you are, even in our service territory of 27 counties, it's a county-by-county story. So particularly struggling areas, rural areas, is where we're seeing a lot of difficulties. We have not really seen a broad reduction in the amount of people that need our help. It's actually stayed steady at a high level. So what does that look like? For us, that looks like about 150,000 people each month are relying on the food bank and our roughly 1,000 partners. And while some areas are doing better, some of the areas here in Dauphin County, maybe Lancaster County, some others, other areas are doing worse. So it's when you get down to ground level, it's a little bit hit or miss as to how families are doing.
What areas are, I don't want to put it that way, that are doing worse, but are in need of your services in particular?
Well, we serve everywhere. So urban, rural, suburban, we have partners in places you wouldn't even think of, like Hershey and places like that. But what we've seen is, as we continue to build out our work, it's harder and more expensive to serve in rural areas. So we continue to put resources in to reach people, families in very small towns where they haven't really seen the job pickup in those areas. So again, it's a bit of a paradox that we could have this strong economy, we could have a roaring stock market, but if you don't have financial investments, if you're struggling, you're not benefiting from that.
Yeah, probably not a lot of people who are suffering from a lack of food have a lot of stocks or have a lot of investments.
Exactly.
So, Paul, I'm interested in someone who has volunteered for years. You're an observer. What do you see? I mean, yes, you see the food coming in, but what about going out and the people who are in need?
That's interesting, because there are three major programs that the food bank runs to support organizations, one for the elderly, a number of programs for children who can't get food, particularly in the summertime. They have special programs. And another program that's relatively new but is growing, and which is particularly meaningful to me being a veteran, is a program for helping veterans. And they send out food to American Legions, VFWs, and other veterans organizations, packaged, ready to go, that goes out to veterans in need. And that's a growing number of veterans that come back and simply can't get jobs or can't make enough money to support their families. And so that's an area in particular that I see is really having an impact.
You know, when you just listed those three groups, is one group affected when, Paul, you said that there's a growth among veterans who are hungry and in need of the services, but is there an impact on any of the other groups when there's a focus that goes to one of those groups?
No, we're actually very strong at raising resources, and I do want to point out, we're about 80% privately funded. So that's people, businesses, foundations supporting us. And our employers are fantastic to us. And I do want to thank one in particular. Our Hunger Action Month is sponsored by PSECU, our presenting sponsor. It's just an example of the support that we get. So we're very, very strong at finding that support. And we live in a generous area. So we're not pulling from one segment of people in need to give to another. We are finding more. And veterans in particular, the public support has been outstanding. What I do want to point out is the support that we're getting now is funding even better food, healthy, nutritious food. Another segment that's not really talked about that much, you touched on wages early on. Working families with children, that actually represents about 6 in 10 of our clients. Almost 60%. I think that's, for the public, that's a surprise. So that's people that are working but not making quite enough to afford all of their bills.
Mm. Our guest during this portion of the program, Joe Arthur, Executive Director of the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank, and volunteer Paul Smith. September is Hunger Action Month. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. You know, again, with that good economic news and in this day and age, there probably are a lot of people that have a vision in their mind of what someone in need looks like. They probably think of someone without a job, someone who is homeless maybe. And as you've just described, that 60% figure, Joe, of working families in need. Here's a basic question. What constitutes hunger? Is it one meal a day, two meals a day, no meals a day?
Really, it's someone who is hungry doesn't have enough nutritious food to live a healthy lifestyle. So it may not come down to one meal a day. It may be episodic, where a family just may be eating for 2 or 3 weeks sufficiently, and then that last week of the month, they really can't find enough food, and that's a problem. Health-wise, we obviously need to eat three good, healthy meals a day. So that's what hunger looks like here in America. It's really not being able to provide or have access to those meals you need each and every day throughout the year. And for some folks, it's an ongoing struggle. You mentioned the homeless. We serve many homeless, but that's a small portion of the population we serve. So what we end up with is folks that may be living on a fixed income, elderly, our veterans, who in that last week or two of the month, they just have empty cabinets and empty refrigerators. And our job is to find them and make sure they have enough food so they're going to make it through the month and be healthy.
That would seem to have been a change from years past when you probably, and I'll ask the question this way, is there food that you turn away? And probably in the years past, you probably would take almost anything, chips, snacks, you know, anything like that. But I know that you're very involved with local farmers, dairy farmers in particular, that with some of the programs with milk. But that is a change in the last few years, isn't it?
It is. Actually, for about 10 years, we've been really ramping up our healthy food focus. So We're blessed. We live in a great food region, good agriculture region. So we've been focusing on fresh fruits and vegetables, fresh milk and other dairy, good healthy meats. And that has allowed us to really build out that kind of sourcing and that kind of distribution. We've invested in the infrastructure with donor funds. So we've been able to pull back on the amount of maybe snack foods and sugary beverages that we might have accepted years ago. We still accept some, but much more in moderation. So really have focused on that. And I think our volunteers like Paul see that in the warehouse.
Exactly. As I understand, 14,000, well, the tons of fresh fruit that come in have to be processed and redistributed fairly quickly, simply because they're fresh. But we process so much of that, tomatoes, potatoes, fruits, that go directly out to immediately to around 100 distribution points to go out to families. So yes, I'm impressed by the focus on nutrition above just providing something to fill your stomach.
And it's fresh. Is it all coming in, the fresh fruit, vegetables, fresh food? Is that coming mostly or all from local sources?
I'll take that one. We actually source 52 weeks a year, and our growing seasons in Pennsylvania are fairly short relative to some areas. So while right now is harvest season, we are just absorbing so much beautiful Pennsylvania produce. And then that'll extend into apple season and pumpkins and all the great stuff that comes in the fall. So after that, we don't want to stop distributing fresh fruits and veggies. So we're sourcing elsewhere with our partnerships regionally. We're blessed to be by the Philadelphia port, so we have a cooperative of food banks, Mid-Atlantic Regional Cooperative, where we source surplus port product that may go to waste. We're able to bid on that and bring that in. And last year, we sourced over 2 million pounds, or about 20% of our produce came that way. So that's beautiful fruits and veggies that are coming from other areas being imported. So really, to do it all year long, you have to source beyond local, but we also love our local farmers. They are just tremendous donors to our mission. And I mentioned dairy earlier. We're in a dairy crisis right now. We're thankful that our farmers still have the presence of mind to donate their wonderful products to us for people in need.
Are there people that, because of a stigma attached maybe in their own minds of seeking help, not wanting to admit that they're needy, that there are more people that you could serve?
That is true, and we do a lot of outreach. And really, we're outreaching not only for physical food assistance, but to help them get benefits like SNAP or food stamps, so folks can actually go to the grocery store in their community. But the stigma is still an issue. It is particularly strong with our wonderful elderly folks who have given so much, many of them veterans who have worked their whole lives and still. You have to work really hard to convince a senior to come in for help. And also working folks. You know, it's hard to go to a pantry. That is not an easy thing to do. If you're used to providing for your family, and then for whatever reason you're not able to do that, that is a culture shock for that individual. So our partners, our volunteers, really try to help people feel at home with the services. No one should feel like they can't come for help.
So how can they come for help? I mean, I'm sure there may be people listening out there who said, you know what, maybe it is time to seek some help. How can they do that?
Absolutely. The easiest way, and most folks have a phone these days that's can access the internet. So you can call our main number, which is 717-564-1700, or go onto our website at centralpafoodbank.org. which has a find help feature, and that will get you to a live person who will reach, once they find your address, once the person who needs help gives them the address, they'll link them up with one of our partners in that community anywhere in 27 counties.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us today and for the work that you do for the needy here in central Pennsylvania, those 27 counties. Joe Arthur, Executive Director of the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank, and volunteer Paul Smith, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And coming up again on Thursday, it's a Smart Talk road trip. If you'd like to join us in York as we go to Martin Library and talk about downtown York and really downtown cities revitalization, you can join us by going to RSVPing, I should say, at WITF.org/events.